Becker, David Boswell, Schwitzer, and Rodriguez on behalf of the appellants, cross appellees, plaintiffs below, Gregory Carson and Patrick Montague. I'd like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal, please. Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. We appreciate this opportunity to address the court. There are many, many issues raised in the briefs. I think the primary issue that brings the parties here today is whether the plaintiffs are employees within the terms of the Wage Payment and Collection Act, and therefore that's where I intend to focus my comments, and I trust the court will steer me elsewhere.
Before you get there, Mr. Boswell, I have just a couple of questions. On the employee independent contractor issue, your argument did not prevail, and you're appealing from the adverse decision on that point.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But on the second issue, which had to do with the contract clause that involved diminution or forfeiture, depending on how you choose to call it, of accrued commissions, you won. Is that right?
Well, I don't think the court ruled exactly we presented a pure breach of contract theory, but yes.
The clause was invalidated.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yet in your opening brief, argued that point too. That is, you appear to be arguing the point that you won. My question is, did your clients end up in the court below with the commissions that they claimed they were entitled to?
Yes, they did.
How are you aggrieved? Why are you here?
Well, I anticipated the possibility of a cross appeal, and that's why in the direct appeal I felt compelled to raise the other contractual grounds to rule in the appellant's or the plaintiff's favor rather than waiving that on appeal.
But at the end of the day, and the only additional relief you could get here is attorney's fees. So that's what you're really arguing for here, isn't it?
Well, actually, Your Honor, the Wage Payment and Collection Act provides for statutory damages for an amount of 10% per day for the amount of wages not timely paid, up to a cap of 100%. It's a double damage provision, and that's what the plaintiffs are seeking. They're contending that they are entitled to statutory damages under the Wage Payment and Collection Act, in addition to attorney's fees, costs, and costs of prosecution. And that's why the question is as to whether the plaintiffs are entitled to relief under the Wage Payment and Collection Act is material. I note that the defendants did not below contest that they had the opportunity to raise the defense that even if the act applied, they had reasonable grounds to dispute the amount owed even under the act. They did not do that. It did not raise that defense. So it's our position that if you find the plaintiffs are protected by the Wage Payment and Collection Act, the defenses have been waived and judgment should be entered for the plaintiffs in the amount due that they've already been awarded below, plus statutory damages doubling that amount, plus attorney's fees costs and costs of prosecution. It's a strong remedy, Your Honors, but that is the statute that the legislature has seen fit to adopt. It's one of the strongest public policies in the state of Delaware. I can't think of a comparable provision.
Your clients got the commissions to which they were contractually entitled, correct?
They were awarded that sum. It was cross-appealed. There has not been payment of that sum. They have not received it. But if the decision below is affirmed, yes.
Well, the policy discussed behind the act in our prior cases really addresses a situation where you were an employee and it was undisputed, you were getting your check, taxes were being withheld, and you didn't get your final payment. And the idea behind the act is to make sure that employees get paid at the termination of their employment, and that's why we have these dramatic remedies and damages. And what you're trying to convince this court is that your client is in the same position of being an employee whose final payment was withheld.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think the public policy is the same. The only difference is rather than being paid at the end of a two-week pay period, my clients were paid at when the contract settled. But they did the work, no different than someone who works by the hour. They did the work, and they say that they're entitled to be paid for it, not only as a matter of contract law and as a matter of the public policies against forfeitures and unconscionabilities, but as employees. And we believe that not only do we have a strong factual record in favor of finding that they're employees, but in fact they are employees as a matter of law. You don't even need to look at the factual record, in fact. You can decide that strictly on the basis of the statutes involved and specifically the professional regulation chapter 29 of Title 25 and its regulations require, and this is what the New Jersey Supreme Court found in REMAX of the Wausau Insurance.
Mr. Boswell, what is it that, in your view, would make these plaintiffs independent contractors of the broker as distinguished from employees? That is, what element is missing here that makes them employees but not independent contractors?
Well, Your Honor, under the restatement test that we say should be applied, there are so many factors, it's hard to isolate one, but I can certainly tell the court some things that would make a difference. And going back to Gooden v. Mitchell, the court said that an independent contractor is one who is hired to achieve a result. My clients were not hired to achieve a result. An independent contractor is accountable for achieving an objective. My clients cannot be held accountable because they were not hired to achieve an objective. They weren't hired to achieve any particular sale, any particular group of sales. They didn't have to make a sale at all. There is no objective. And that's why, I mean, not only technically, but fundamentally, this is the opposite of a true independent contractor relationship. They were not expected to sell any division, any house, any group of houses. They simply worked indefinitely in their employer's best interest. And therefore, I mean, usually an independent contractor, for example, a builder, might be hired to complete a house. In Fairfield Builders v. Atlanta, they were hired to complete a shopping mall. Well, if they fail to complete that shopping mall, then they fail to deliver the result and may be sued for breach of contract for failing to deliver what they promise. And if the employer who retained them discharges them before they have attained that result, then they may have a suit against the person that contracted for this result for refusing to allow them to achieve it. In this case, there is no such dichotomy. The very essential description and not just the details of an independent contractor relationship are not present here.
Well, I asked you what the elements were, and the one answer I got was that your clients were not hired to achieve a particular objective. Is there any other earmark or element?
Yes, I think in employment at will, the time element of employment, the power, and this is related to the last point, but when there's a power to terminate at will, I think the restatement and Delaware courts have said you infer judicially a power of control to the employer, because when you're not achieved for a specific result but may be fired at any time, then that power to fire at any time is something that's going to bend a reasonable person to the employer's will.
So if there can be a termination at will, then this is an employment at will. That's what you're arguing. But it couldn't be an independent contractor relationship at will.
Well, I think under the standard, I don't know that you can look at any one factor, even control, Your Honor. Control is usually considered to be the most important factor in determining whether one is an employee or independent contractor. But
all I asked you is whether it's legally possible to have an independent contractor relationship that's terminable at will, just as it is legally possible to have an employment relationship that's terminable at will.
I think, Your Honor, if all the other factors point towards an independent contractor relationship and someone is terminable at will, that one factor alone would not render one an employee if all the other factors pointed towards an independent contractor relationship. And that's why I mentioned the control factor, Your Honor. I don't know if any one factor is decisive, but that one under the control test, as it's called, that's the one most likely to be decisive. Under the more modern standard, concerning the relative nature of the work, you look to the relationship between the employee or the one hired's work and the one hiring's job. So if Seacoast hired a painter to work to paint their realty brokerage, and this is a good example, even if they wanted to essentially nitpick or control the details of what the painter's doing, well, I wanted you to start out back first because I have customers coming in the front this time of day.
Well, what are the implications of our holding if you prevail? I assume this isn't the only relationship that's structured this way in the real estate community. If we hold that your clients were in fact employees, then anybody who's writing agreements such as the one your client entered into will now know those agreements have to be rewritten, and are we going to then have some type of wages withheld because they're employees? Are they then going to be eligible for workman's compensation, or entitled to health benefits? What are the implications of holding that situations like this really aren't independent contractors, but they're employment agreements?
I think the implications are positive, Your Honor. The implications are when realtors real estate agents who work, who give their labor just as any other worker, make a sale, when they earn their pay, they get it. I think that's a good thing. I don't know that it requires a whole-scale revision of these so-called independent contractor agreements. It just requires the forfeiture clauses be deleted therefrom, and I think that's what the statute envisions.
Well,
it's not going to.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
You seem to be suggesting that we can parse this agreement and read it in isolation. So you appear to be asking us to hold that for purposes of your claim, they're employees. But my question is, when the next case comes before us and someone says, for purposes of workman compensation, we're employees, do we then distinguish the holding that you're asking us to make? Or do we say, yes, you're an employee for that purpose also?
I think that the court's need to distinguish is going to flow from the statutes. The Workers' Compensation Act contains a loophole that prevents real estate agents from being considered employees and entitled to benefits thereunder unless the brokerage elects to treat them as employees. And in fact, they are treated as employees if they're paid other than on a commission basis. The court's decision here also would not affect their tax treatment because there is a special Internal Revenue Code loophole that Delaware's tax code adopts. So if they want to call themselves independent contractors for the revenue raising purposes of the state, there is no bar to that. It would not disturb the way that they're performing withholding because that's what the tax code provides. But the question is, does the state and federal government's revenue raising purposes have any material impact on the separate pronouncement in the Wage Payment and Collection Act as to the policy that those who work should be paid and paid promptly?
Well, thank you. Mr. Boswell, we're using your rebuttal time. Do you want to continue or reserve that?
I'd like to reserve it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Byard?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. I should have said good morning to you, Mr. Hutt, also earlier.
May it please the Court, it's my privilege to introduce to the Court Mr. Hutt, who will present argument on behalf of Seacoast and on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Valiant.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, as Mr. Byard just indicated, my name is David Hutt, and I represent Seacoast Realty, Celeste Valiant, and John Valiant, the defendants in the court below, the appellees and cross-appellants in this court. As Mr. Boswell indicated at the outset of his argument, one of the primary issues before the court today is the application of the Wage Payment and Collection Act to this matter, or more specifically, does the Wage Payment and Collection Act apply here? Are Mr. Montague and Mr. Carson employees within the meaning of the Act? As was argued in the court below and as the court below found, Seacoast takes the position that they have an independent contractor relationship with their sales personnel.
Well, can you help us understand how they're independent contractors in light of the tightly scripted requirements, for want of a better term, that seem to have been imposed about going to meetings at a certain time, doing things in a certain way? I got the impression that those weren't suggestions, that that was really the preference, that things be done that way, and if they weren't done that way, then there was concern. In fact, it ultimately led to the termination of this contract. So help us understand what latitude they really had.
They had the latitude of not being full-time agents. They had the, I suppose it's a subject of some dispute, as was indicated in the facts that went back and forth in the briefing. They had the latitude of a schedule that was very flexible. I think that they will disagree with how flexible that was. But I would note that across the motions for summary judgment, this court defers to the factual findings of the trial court, and the trial court had these issues that Mr. Boswell has raised both in the court below and in this brief before it, and found that these were either maintenance-related items, rules required to help the business run efficiently, or conditions imposed through the commission, real estate commission, and the statutory construction.
Well, Mr. Hutt, I just want to mention before we get too far on the standard of review, our court doesn't defer at all to factual findings in motions for summary judgment because it's a paper record, and we have cases that say we can review the paper record just as the trial court could. And the only time we defer to the factual findings of the trial court is when there have been credibility assessments. So, and that brings me back to my question. When we have all of these requirements that say be in a certain place at a certain time, do things in a certain format, normally an independent contractor could say, my job is to rake your yard, and I'm going to get your yard raked if that's what I'm hired to do, and at the end of the day, it's going to be clean. But the idea of starting on the right and moving to the left, putting all the leaves in the pile in the middle, bagging them up, different things like that, would be probably something left to the discretion of the independent contractor. That's what I'm trying to see here, because if you look at what was expected of them, it's hard to distinguish what would be expected of an employee.
I think that the answer lies largely in the fact that the real estate industry is and has been for some time a highly regulated industry at the state level, at the statutory level, and at the regulatory level. And it creates a construction where the broker is ultimately responsible for every transaction that each of its salespersons undertakes. In order to do that, the broker reviews listing agreements, reviews any advertising that these individual salespersons are going to send out, and
well, does the regulatory scheme require that the salespeople dress in a certain way?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that there's a
does the regulatory scheme require that their professional cards be crafted in a particular format?
To some extent, I think it does.
And how's that?
And I know that this regulation was not promulgated or passed by the commission until shortly after the salesperson, Mr. Montague and Carson, left, but it does regulate whose phone number can appear on certain advertising things.
How about the size of the font or where the names of the salespeople are located on the card. Is that regulated?
No, there's no express regulation regarding font size.
Does the record in this case show how, if at all, the degree of micromanagement, which I use in place of the legally charged word control, differs in the case of Seacoast from that of other real estate brokerage firms in Delaware?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor.
It does not.
And it, I guess in getting back and responding to your question, Justice Holland, if you look at any construction site, independent contractors are heavily regulated. Many of the contracts require their subcontractors to wear hard hats, wear certain safety clothes. Their signs can only be of certain size. They can only work on certain hours at the job. These are not indicative of the fact that that has created a employee-employer relationship. They're just certain things that, for practical reasons, whether it be maintenance-related or whether it be to make the job site run more efficiently so the building gets constructed in an orderly fashion, Seacoast, similarly, wants its business to be run professionally, wants its associates to look a certain way. It wants to have a certain presence in the community. I don't think that these things, and the court below agreed, that these things did not equate them or change their status from independent contractors to that of employer and employee. As this court found in the Fairfield case referenced earlier, each case requires an individual analysis. The court below properly did an individual analysis of that in this case. Mr. Boswell has argued, as he did below, that there should be the expanded test from the restatement of agency. As was shown in the briefs, courts choose different factors from that test to focus on in determining the relationship between individuals, whether it is that of independent contractor or that of employer and employee. And this court chose in Fairfield to focus on certain factors.
And what was the underlying disagreement in this case? Why did the relationship end?
It's my understanding that the relationship ended because Mr. Montague and Carson's disregard for the policy of Seacoast was causing a lot of strife in the office. These were two excellent agents.
What was the policy that was the problem? Can you give us some examples?
I believe that they chose to not attend the weekly sales meetings. They took themselves off of the schedule. They printed some mailers without seeking the broker's approval. These are all things that Seacoast policy had a policy on, and they were choosing to ignore those policies. I believe that they took everything out of their offices and would come into Seacoast's office after hours. I believe that these are the things that created conflict within Seacoast's organization, and once that conflict rose to a certain level, Seacoast terminated its relationship so that its business could move forward.
Well, what Mr. Boswell is arguing is what you're characterizing as policy was in fact terms of employment. And how would you distinguish that? He's saying if they really were independent agents who, as you acknowledge, were performing well and providing good results, they should have been able to do all of those things. And that, you know, the policy would have been really kind of best efforts, suggestions, but it wouldn't be something, if you violated, that would result in a termination of your contract.
Again, in response to that, I guess I'm going to return again to the construction analogy. If a subcontractor on a job site begins to violate whatever parameters have been set, whatever those parameters are, it would not seem strange for a general contractor to terminate that relationship.
Most of the examples you gave on the construction site were OSHA regulations or some other type of safety regulations. I think all of us would agree ignoring OSHA regulations and safety requirements are not optional for either employees or independent contractors.
And similarly, Your Honor, I would say ignoring real estate commission policy and regulations, for instance, review, making sure that people's mailers include proper phone numbers and that sort of thing. Similarly, I would say that the broker of record ultimately ends up being responsible.
But was that required in the contract with these particular individuals? Did the contract say you must pre-clear all of your mailers with the Valiance?
I don't know if it's in the contract, Your Honor. I believe it was part of the policy, and I'm not sure.
I'm asking what's in the contract. What's written down? Did the contract require it?
I don't know the exact answer to your question. I believe the contract clearly stated that.
Did the contract require that these plaintiffs or any of the salespeople attend sales meetings?
The contract stated, Your Honor, that it was attendance is, I'm trying to think of the exact words.
Optional.
Expected, or something that the weekly sales meetings are an important part of Seacoast's mission, and that regular attendance is expected at
these meetings.
Would
that be a requirement couched in softer language?
I don't believe it's a requirement. I believe it's exactly what it says it is. It was a suggestion, an expectation.
For which broker could terminate the salesperson if that salesperson didn't follow that strong suggestion.
Certainly. If the salesperson did not like the fact that they had a weekly sales meeting, they were free to join another broker.
Well, if you were writing this opinion for the court, how would you distinguish between a policy that would maintain this independent contractor relationship and terms of employment? Because the policy in this case, we're going to have to distinguish from what would look like terms of employment.
I believe, Your Honor, that the distinguishing part in this is that you have a statute in Chapter 29 of Title 25 that creates a strict regulatory construct. At the same time, the legislature was not mandating an employment relationship, as is evidenced in Title 19 labor, which creates methods by which a broker can have an independent contractor relationship with its sales associates. When the broker elects to do that, as was evidenced in this, as Seacoast would argue is evidenced in this relationship, then that policy is fulfilled. This is not, facially, it's not an employment relationship, and we would argue that even when you, for lack of a better term, tear it apart, it's still not an employment relationship. And so I don't know exactly how I would write the policy for that, but I believe that because each case requires an individual analysis, when this one is analyzed, Seacoast's as the court below put it, maintenance-related items and items to help a business run efficiently so they know when there's going to be somebody in the office, if they didn't have some sort of a schedule, how would they ever know if anybody was ever going to be in the office? They would have a difficult time running a business. And when you, those things in concert with the statutory and regulatory constructs in Delaware that exist and are mentioned in the briefs do not create employment, they create an independent contracting relationship.
Let me just ask a follow-up question. What Justice Holland asked you, what term would you add or subtract? That is, what variable would you put into the existing fact pattern that, in your view, would convert this relationship from an independent contractor relationship to a an employer-employee relationship. What's missing here?
I think what's missing is the, Your Honor, is the next layer, the next way that you enforce attendance at a sales meeting. The deposition test of transcripts show that Celeste Valiant indicated that she did not even know that they weren't attending the sales meetings until it was brought to her attention by somebody else. If this is an employee-employer relationship, you know exactly, I assume a good employer is going to know exactly where all their employees are during the whatever period of time it is that they're required to be on the job. Mr. Boswell argued a short time ago that they were not hired to achieve a result. I would dispute that. They were most certainly hired to achieve a result, that is to sell and list properties in Sussex County, Delaware. So the missing element, I believe, is just the next step up.
What is the next step up?
Even a more stricter relationship. You're required to work this many hours a week. If you're 1 hour late, there's this penalty. If you have four vacation days, six sick days, et cetera. I mean, those are the types of things that I would assume employers guide for their employees, creation of a retirement account, provision of medical benefits, things that are typical with an employer-employee relationship. The second issue, which the court below found or invalidated the forfeiture or diminution clause, was the court went to a liquidated damage analysis. The parties below did not raise the liquidated damages analysis. The court sought that out on its own, and in doing so, Seacoast believes that it applied the wrong standard. In order to use a liquidated damages construct, there needs to be a breach of contract. There was no breach of contract in this case. The parties have had an agreement that they could terminate their relationship at any time. When one party chooses to exercise the option of terminating a contract, that does not mean that there was a breach of contract. And without a breach of contract, a liquidated damages analysis doesn't fit well in the situation.
Well, didn't the court employ a liquidated damages analysis simply in order to conclude that this was not a liquidated damages clause? It was another kind of clause that was void as against public policy.
To an extent, I would agree that the court did employ the liquidated damages analysis to say it's not a proper liquidated damages clause, it's a penalty.
So shouldn't your focus be on whether or not this is a penalty, and if it was a penalty, whether it should be invalidated on public policy grounds?
I guess, Your Honor, my problem with that analysis is that in order to say it's a penalty, you have to use a liquidated damage analysis, and it doesn't appear to me that there's a breach here, and nobody has articulated a breach, and therefore I'm not certain why we would apply a liquidated damages analysis looking for damages in light of a breach. These were people who terminated, and the contract talked about how that termination, for lack of a better term, would be wound up.
Well, I suppose that I'm agreeing with you that at least arguably there shouldn't have been any damages, liquidated damages analysis. But nonetheless, there was an independent rationale for invalidating the clause, and you haven't addressed it.
Your Honor, the purpose, as I stated, there wasn't any factual record on the purpose. The court below surmised some purposes, protection of the public, protection of the broker. As I indicated in what I included in my brief, the broker of record has no way of knowing at the outset of relationship what what level that salesperson will achieve. And in that respect, if the transaction in question is less than $50,000, even $100,000, the numbers are in my brief.
Thank you, Mr. Hutt.
I see the court's point regarding the liquidated damage analysis, but it seems to me that the defendants are trying to have it both ways. They have a contract that doesn't lay out any of these other expectations that we've heard they required of the plaintiffs and that they, in fact, fired them for. And yet, when they fire them for violating these expectations, which aren't in the four corners of the contract, they say there's no breach. Well, clearly, they thought there was a breach, as that term is commonly understood. They had expectations, and the plaintiffs failed to comply with it. In that regard, a liquidated damage analysis is appropriate. But I think Your Honor has hit it on the head. There are several different doctrines, a condition, forfeiture, unconscionability, bad faith, all these things go to perhaps a simple expression from the courts of equity, the law abhors a forfeiture.
And this isn't really a forfeiture, is it? I mean, basically, it's a diminution in how much your clients are going to receive on the remaining contracts or deals that are out there. But it's not... If the provision said, upon termination, anything that's not gone to closing, you lose, then we could say, okay, there's a forfeiture here. You've done some work, you get nothing. But this is a provision that says, when you leave, anything that's pending, you get a lower level of compensation, and you get potential reduction for the costs of bringing it to closing. It may not be particularly favorable to your clients to have that provision in there, but by what method do we see this rising to the level of being a forfeiture or so punitive as to be void against public policy?
Well, Your Honor, they got their base compensation, but they were promised increased marginal commissions, and they're losing 100% of those increased marginal commissions based on their cumulative performance. So one of the things they do to earn that is to sell lots of property, and they had to work hard to do that. They are forfeiting all the increased marginal commissions promised.
So your point is that there's may not be a total forfeiture, but there's a partial forfeiture?
Well, it's a total forfeiture of the increased marginal commissions. If you're to look at the totality of their compensation, it would be a partial forfeiture.
What are we talking about in terms of dollars? Using the provision that's in the contract versus the provision versus the commissions that would be payable under the regular framework, what's the difference in dollar value?
Well, I'm a little confused by the question, Your Honor, because that's one of the points of the brief, is that the forfeiture clause is not in the contract. It's an aside policy. But that distinction aside, it's roughly 50%. Together, I think the plaintiffs lost about $50,000, I think $19,000 for Mr. Montague, $26,000 for Mr. Carson. The base level is between 42% and 45-odd%, and the level that they were at was closer to 80-85%. So it's about half of the total pay.
Well, help me recall the record. Does the contract incorporate these policies by reference, or did your client sign a separate writing that said, as a condition for being independent contractors, they accept the policy?
No, they didn't sign any separate policy. The contract incorporates the commission schedule. And this is a little counterintuitive. There is a compensation policy, but the commission schedule is just one paragraph in that policy. So only the commission schedule was incorporated into the contract by reference, not the totality of the compensation policy.
Well, does that schedule contemplate the reduction that Seacoast wanted to bring about in this case, or is that part of the separate policy?
It's part of the separate. It's not part of the commission schedule, but it's part of the larger compensation policy,
right,
and it's not part of the contract.
Well, would that be an alternative basis for affirming what the court did? In other words, that this did you argue, and did the court just not reach the question of whether this clause even applies because it was not part of the contract and it was not referred to, brought in by reference?
The court, I think in oral argument, the court said it didn't find that that argument persuasive. I don't know that it was addressed specifically in the court's decision. I think the court's decision declined to address.
Right. I'm talking about whether the court was presented with that argument, not whether it.
Yes, it was presented below, okay, Your Honor. All of the arguments in plaintiff's opening brief were presented below, and that's why they were presented here. I seem to be out of time. The one thing I would say is this decision will not affect or change anything. I think the same result obtains under the employment discrimination statute or under a tort claim where a motorist is injured by a real estate agent. The court would reach the same decision we're asking to today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boswell. Thank you both. The court appreciates your argument. We'll take a brief recess, and we'll take this matter under advisement.